This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. What is community policing depends largely on who you ask. ISU criminal justice professor Kara Raby-Hemp says it starts with a philosophy that citizens will co-produce crime control.
How police departments have taken that philosophy, though, and transferred that into strategies and in tactics is what is primarily where the debate lies within community policing.
You'll hear about the wide variations of how police departments go about community policing. Questions about police intent arose during the debate over whether the Bloomington Police Department should operate a substation on the city's west side. You'll also hear from the president of the nonprofit police association about research he's conducted into another form of law enforcement, hotspot policing. And Bloomington's top cop, Brendan Hefner, will add local context to the dialogue. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 20th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Late last year, the city of Bloomington announced plans to convert a home on the city's west side into a police substation. The announcement was greeted with surprise and criticism among many in the Black Lives Matter Blono community. They took exception to what they called very little notice to the collaboration of Bloomington Police and Mid-Central Community Action on what is now called the Jefferson Street Community House. BLM wanted input into the house and into how police conducted business, asking for a community policing approach rather than what they characterized as broken windows policing. But what exactly is community policing? We'll spend today's show delving into that and other styles of law enforcement that are being put into practice right here in Bloomington Normal. GLT's John Norton sat down with Illinois State University criminal justice professor Kara Raby-Hemp for a macro look at a style of policing that has been gaining traction over the last three decades.
I'm asking it this way purposely.
Okay.
What is community policing?
That's a really good question. Much of the debate about community policing has to do with this debate about what community policing means. So community policing has core tenets of philosophies, strategies, and tactics that are associated with it. Generally speaking, the philosophy is this idea that citizens will co-produce crime control, meaning they will take an active part in reducing crime in their neighborhoods. How police departments have taken that philosophy, though, and transferred that into strategies and in tactics is what is primarily where the debate lies within community policing. So let me give you some examples. One of the common strategies associated with community policing is foot patrol. So officers patrol on foot rather than in automobiles, which is associated with traditional policing. While they're on foot, then they have greater access to citizens, business owners. So it allows them to go back to that philosophy, which is to interact with citizens on a much more common basis. Other parts of that strategies are having geographical focuses or beats where officers have a neighborhood that they're responsible for the crime in that neighborhood. And then this idea of prevention, of preventing crime, rather than waiting for it to happen and then responding. So what community policing does as far as an idea and what the actual strategies and tactics are, there's sometimes a disjoint between that.
We had a preliminary talk. Was it late last year? And you told me at that time that one of the critiques of community policing is that it, and I'm paraphrasing, it's more talk than walk. Why is that?
Okay. So going back to the philosophy I mentioned a moment ago, this idea that citizens are co-producers of crime control in their community. Can a police department simply utilize foot patrol for the majority of their patrolling needs and call them a community policing department? Is that enough to define themselves as community policing? Or can a police department create a citizen advisory board and not change anything else about what they're doing and now be a community policing department? You know, right now in American policing, some of this issue is related to the militarization and the rise of the militarization of police at the same time when police departments are saying they're doing community policing.
That is my exact question I was going to ask. Okay, go.
So this is where we're at now. The increased militarization of police departments in the past 30 years, coupled with Get Tough policies that we have in criminal justice, have had devastating consequences for communities, especially when we look at communities of color. A recent ACLU investigation into police raids found that not only have police departments become increasingly militarized, especially just in the 2000s, but that this militarization has occurred with virtually no oversight. So when they studied these paramilitary raids that officers are using military teams, paramilitary teams like SWAT teams, or more commonly today referred to as SRT teams, they found that 80% of those were for ordinary, everyday law enforcement purposes. That would be things like serving warrants in people's homes. Only about 7% of those were for genuine emergencies, or what they were created, what those teams were created to do, such as barricades or hostage situations. You know, one of the most significant consequences of the paramilitarization of policing under the guise of community policing is that these raids have disproportionately targeted people of color. That has led us really to this point where we are at today, where there is, you know, a legitimacy crisis in policing, where police departments specifically and the communities that they're sworn to protect and serve are at a disjoint.
Well, understanding that each police department does, I'll put it in quotes, does community policing in its own way, what does the data show about how effective it is overall, or maybe how different ways of community policing are more effective than others?
Here's what we know that I think is most important, regardless of the critiques of community policing. You know, at the end of the day, after, 30, 40 years of community policing, most empirical research suggests that community policing does not reduce violent crime. What community policing does really, really well, its legacy, which we need to pay close attention to today, is that it acknowledges that the police cannot do their job without citizens. I think to understand how this works, we have to look closely at this, at the ideas of informal and formal social control. Okay, so informal social control is made up of people who care about you, who you don't want to disappoint. So I'm going to use an example. I grew up in a small town, and in my small town of Anarga, there were lots of people that cared about me as a young person. So I had a church family, I had school teachers who paid close attention to me, and just community members and neighbors, and they cared about me, and I didn't want to disappoint them. So their informal social control, and they were a really strong mechanism on me, on my decision making when I was a young person. That coupled with this idea of density of acquaintanceship, which is this, I'll give you another great example. The first time I took my Ford Mustang out as a 16-year-old and I was speeding and I got pulled over by a local police officer. When I got home that night, my dad was standing in the front yard with his hand out for my keys, right? He had already heard that had happened within an hour of it occurring. So those types of controls on our behavior are really, really strong. The police are not informal social control. They are a social institution that are formal control. In community policing, what we are attempting to do is replace this idea of informal social control with formal control. So the reason that this matters is there are communities that community policing is naturally occurring. They have high levels of informal social control. They are already interested in co-producing crime control in those communities. They look out for one another. They pay attention to things that are suspicious. They take care of their neighbors and their family members. In those places, community policing is wildly successful because it's naturally occurring. What's difficult about community policing is when you try to take that and apply that, let's say, maybe to an urban space or to a space where there is less informal social control, where neighbors do not look out for one another. They may not even know who their neighbor is. They might not know their name. They don't know if it's suspicious if someone is moving a television out of their apartment because it's moving day or because they are having their apartment burglarized. The reality today is that if communities and neighborhoods want to reduce crime in their communities, they need to actively participate in that crime reduction. The police simply cannot reduce crime, prevent crime, and solve crime on their own.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with ISU Criminal Justice Professor Kara Raby-Hemp. You've talked about informal social control and how it's necessary to successful policing. That is, citizens in a nutshell are paying attention to the neighborhood. They know people in the neighborhood. What are some of the more intentional or formal controls that have worked around the idea of community policing?
Problem-solving policing and involving partnerships with non-criminal justice agencies to produce characteristics in a neighborhood that make it less inviting to crime and more likely for people to be able to have access to the resources they need to be successful.
You mean like decluttering streets of parked cars and fixing fences and just things like that? Is that what you're getting
at? You got it. So coupling a city's sanitation department with a group of citizens that are interested in cleaning up that neighborhood to make it less inviting to crime. Or working specifically in neighborhoods where there are buildings that are targets for crime or for drug use, having those buildings eliminated. All of those are just examples of how criminal justice actors like police can work with non-criminal justice actors and community activists to solve crime problems in their communities.
So I want to make sure I have this right. When it's done well, community policing does great things for nonviolent crimes. But violent crimes, there's nothing really community policing can do because it's a whole different animal?
That's right. Because violent crime, oftentimes, if you think about it, is related to a personal crime. It's about relationships, right? And relationships are really about that informal social control. The only way to reduce violent crime in communities is to have community members work together.
Does the police have to initiate that, or does that come from the groups they're already partnering with, or are they groups that are not partnering with have to come to the police to solve those problems?
That is a great question. I'm going to tell you that in communities where they have won the support of community groups, activists and neighborhood groups, they have been much more successful than when the police are left to engage in this problem solving on their own. I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. Police need citizens to be effective at doing their job. You know, this is true today more than ever as we have a shortage. Most departments are under authorized strength. They absolutely need citizens to report crimes to them, to watch out for things that are suspicious in their neighborhood, and to identify for the police departments what some of those underlying causes of crime are so that they can play an active role in reducing crime problems in their neighborhoods.
All right. Well, how about this? Can a department that's only implementing certain what I'll call outreach moments, coffee with a cop, even a police substation or a specialized unit of a neighborhood officer or officers, as opposed to infusing the entire department from the academy to ongoing training with the values of community policing, is it really community policing if you're just doing some of those what I called outreach moments? Or does that fall into the whole vague definition of community policing?
I think it gets into the vague definition. And more important to me, I mean, it's an interesting academic question, but to people every day who are interacting with police officers in their neighborhood, I think this is the important part. The important part is that we know now, after all these years of studying police and police strategy and its effect on crime, that there's really no magic cure for crime in society. There is no one type of policing that works everywhere. And so what's really important to remember is that they have to be unique to the community. So the reality is that departments need to adopt a policing philosophy, tactics, and strategies that work for whatever the crime problems are that exist in that neighborhood. And so this debate about whether or not something meets the definition of community policing, like I said, is interesting for us to talk about. But I think for people that are on the streets policing and citizens that are fighting crime problems in their neighborhood, really looking at this problem solving, which, you know, involves specific crime and disorder problems, that is what's been most effective. A community-based, a specific neighborhood-based look at what's happening in those neighborhoods, and then partnering with criminal justice and non-criminal justice agencies that can make the change that needs to take place. And that means that each police department is going to have to carefully examine the underlying causes of crime in the neighborhoods in their jurisdiction and form crime policies and practices that can address those. That's a very different sort of task for police than what we've asked policing to do over the last, you know, several hundred years. And so it's going to require a very specific shift, requires officers to be much more involved in the community. It involves them to be analysts and to be able to analyze the underlying problems for crime. And it also requires police departments to have enough time in between responding to calls for service to actually do some of this in-depth analysis.
Let me ask you about this. There's a perception among many, and I think some of it is fair, that there's a certain type of person that is attracted to law enforcement, and the word authoritarian is what comes to mind. How does that type of person who wants to be in law enforcement adapt to the collaborative idea of what we're talking about, of what community policing is?
I think the type of officer that you describe is sort of an outdated picture of what police do, frankly. In teaching students in the criminal justice sciences department, our students leave our program in criminal justice today. They understand the importance of building relationship with community members. They take specialized courses on a cultural competency, dealing with issues related to mental illness in the field, crisis intervention training, de-escalation techniques. So I think that the officers that are leaving education programs today are equipped to handle some of this analysis that we're going to require of officers in the next decade.
What about the ones that aren't leaving educational institutions? Because we obviously have a problem in some areas. In most cities, there's a problem with at least a handful of officers.
I think that that is a fair critique of what we're seeing as far as expecting something different from police officers than what we did 15 years ago. I don't want to act like police haven't always had to be smart, because they are. I interview police officers on a regular basis, and they're really bright and they're already analytical. But I think this idea of being problem solvers and having a community-based focus or a neighborhood-based focus is something that we're going to have to continue to work on.
That's Kara Raby-Hemp. She's an Illinois State University criminal justice professor. I'm John Norton, and this is GLT Sound Ideas. Kara, it's one thing for the upper levels of a police department, any law enforcement agency, to embrace the whole idea, whether it's a value system, whatever it is, whole idea of community policing. And it's another for that whole idea to get filtered all the way down to the street level.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see cases where it's given a web page, it's given face value, but it doesn't get down to the street?
Of course.
And Does that happen a lot?
It happens a lot in the history of policing, not just with community policing, but with all police reforms. If you study policing as kind of a student of the history of policing, there have been all sorts of reforms in policing that have been wildly popular for 5 or 10 years and then have faded away because of lots of resistance and obstacles to being adopted. The other major critique of community policing is that it failed to win the hearts and minds of your everyday line officer. I think the shift that you're talking about of requiring police to do a different type of job came at the same time as community policing. And so there was resistance, right, to that shift. Today, though, 30, 40 years later, right? At least 20 years later, depending on where you're looking at the adoption of community policing as the origin. I think police officers assume that this is part of the job today.
Okay. Well, there is a lot of tension between police and the public, and maybe some of it just, acknowledged more in the media than ever before. But what problems do we run into if this lack of perception or lack of understanding among the two groups can't be worked out?
Okay. The difficulty in that is that if policing is a social institution, if their legitimacy continues to be critiqued, and right now it's an onslaught. Like I said, everyone from the president of the United States, former president of the United States, the media and citizens abroad are critiquing police practices. If you look, there was a recent Pew poll that looked at whether or not these events, these high-profile shootings, are indicative of deeply entrenched attitudes and behavior in policing or just aberration, isolated events. 60% of police said these are aberrated. These are just isolated events. And the majority of the police, have positive interactions with citizens. Only about, 35 of citizens believe that. The overwhelming majority of citizens believe that police need to be more accountable and that their behavior is discriminatory in some nature. That matters to policing. Policing cannot be perceived by citizen as a discriminatory and an illegitimate social institution and have them continue to be able to protect citizens and provide services to citizens. Those two things are incongruent. So whether it's through a community-based program, whether it's through problem solving, neighborhood members and community members and police have to form alliances to reduce crime in their neighborhoods. It will not work well if they continue to work against one another.
Who's right?
I think time will tell. When we're looking specifically at these high-profile shootings, what we know is that in actuality, violence between citizens and police is extremely rare. It is not something that happens on a regular basis. But that does not mean that the shootings that we've seen and the feelings that people express upon seeing those are not correct or that they aren't also right.
30% of the public thinks they're isolated. 70% thinks it's not isolated of the public.
Generally, yeah, the numbers are close.
And on the police side, it's higher.
It's flipped.
It's totally flipped.
It's almost, flipped.
But it does mean 30% of police think this is not an isolated incident.
Right, that there are deeper issues.
That's interesting. That's a pretty high percentage, more than I would have guessed.
So I can tell you this, that when we're talking about police use of force is a rare thing. So depending on where in the United States you are, anywhere between about 1 and 20% of citizen interactions end in some level of force. Remember, some level of force includes anything from spitting to deadly force. Okay. So there's a continuum of behaviors there in the police use of force continuum. So generally speaking, it's really rare. When you start to look at these high profile shootings that we've mentioned a couple times, they are exceedingly rare. But because of technology, we are all increasingly aware of those, right? So that's the change. It's not as if there hasn't been violence between police and citizens previously. It's that we're much more aware of them because of the footage that's been shot of them and the sharing of those, not only in the media, but also in social media.
So in your research, do you have any statistics on police, why they wouldn't understand how the general public would feel?
What's really interesting is that actually research up until the last couple of years has suggested that citizens feel much more positively about police than what police perceive.
Really?
Does that make... Oh, yeah. Astronomically more.
But they feel under siege right now.
They feel under siege.
Over the last few years, especially.
They do feel under siege.
Probably since Ferguson,
and,
right?
And, it's interesting. Well, and the Dallas shooting, solidified that attitude. I mentioned I've been interviewing police officers. I interviewed an officer the other day, and she said that, police officers today are being hunted, and that's the first time in history that that's true. When we try to filter police behavior and police attitudes and how they're feeling on the job, you have to acknowledge that policing is a really tough job. And it's a very thankless, tough job usually. And to go to work every day feeling like you're being hunted, that your livelihood, that your life is at risk. And I don't want to be too dramatic, but that was the quote that was shared. That we have to filter that through some of the comments that we're hearing, right, related to police accountability. I think that this is a really tough time to be a police officer.
That's ISU Criminal Justice Professor Kara Raby-Hemp speaking with GLT's John Norton.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And I'm Willis Kern. Just ahead during Sound Ideas, it's a conversation with Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner. At a community meeting last December with Hefner and the local chapter of Black Lives Matter, it quickly became clear many members of the minority community view the police with anger and distrust. Chief Hefner has said he concentrates many of his officers in neighborhoods with the highest incident rates to prevent crime from happening. But many minority residents complain that their neighborhoods are under a microscope, with police making unfair stops and unnecessary arrests. Here are a few of the comments from both black and white citizens who spoke at that forum.
I have had my share of negative interactions with Bloomington police, from having guns drawn on me for wearing what the police officer stated were gang colors, to getting searched down to my socks in the rain for non-existent drugs. I know one thing for sure, is that these interactions would have never escalated to the state that they reached if I was a white person.
I saw Joseph gesture with his finger to his hand, point to his ears, and shrug. Officers had hands on him before we got to the other side of the street. He was being arrested. I called to the officers as they were moving him around the van. He was helping the situation. He wasn't hurting it. The officers immediately started walking away from us. Another person asked, why is he being detained? I heard from the officer, he was dancing in the street. No, he wasn't dancing. Why are you detaining him? Someone said. I heard, he wouldn't show us ID. Joseph is hearing impaired. He was asking for a notepad to write something down. He was being charged with one count of walking in the highway, and two counts of resisting arrest.
If military personnel can risk their lives and de-escalate a situation, then police officers should take lessons from the military instead of garnishing the gear and acquiring the equipment and playing military dress-up while intimidating citizens. If a police officer's first initial thought process is to shoot and kill an innocent unarmed civilian because they fear for their lives, then I suggest that you reconsider a different and safe occupation.
That was Candace Byrd, Henry Dick, and Chris Rawls speaking at a Black Lives Matter forum on their encounters with police. The Bloomington Department uses a common law enforcement procedure known as hotspot policing. And we'll hear from Brendan Hefner, the Bloomington Police Chief, in just a moment. This hotspot policing means a larger number of officers are sent to patrol the highest crime areas. But is hotspot policing effective? Jim Bierman's the president of the Police Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit research group. And Bierman tells GLT's Judy Valente that hotspot policing can be effective if it is properly enforced and if the police build support for it by developing closer relationships with community members.
There is a lot of evidence that shows when the police focus on those very small places that generate disproportionate numbers of crime, that they can make a difference. And by these places, I'm talking about very small places like street blocks, this block versus that block.
Or does that just encourage the criminals to go elsewhere if all your patrols are in one area?
The evidence also actually shows that you almost never get what's called displacement as it moves from this place to another place. So as a policing strategy, hotspots policing is one of the best strategies the police can use to try to reduce crime. But there is a huge caveat to this. The other part of this is, how do you go about implementing that in a way that is comfortable for the community? And this is where community policing kicks in, because we are a strong advocate in this idea of the co-production of public safety. In other words, the community and the police working together and agreeing on strategies means that you have open dialogue and discussions and interaction with the community leaders, to talk about the nature of crime and what we know works and how can we implement this in a way that it is perceived appropriately and that everybody gets exposure to the ideas, why does this work and what we're going to do, so that you co-produce the decision to use hotspots policing. It isn't done unilaterally with the police.
I've been looking at some sites and some of the research on this, and it seems to be mixed, the research, including things that you have on your own Police Foundation website. Studies seem to be mixed as to whether it's somewhat effective or very effective or not so effective.
It's very important to remember that when you're looking at an individual study, that study almost always is looking at how a model is implemented at a particular place. So a study that has mixed results at City A by Police Department A may be reflecting two things. One, and the most important thing, is that the police are not implementing hotspots policing with a high degree of what's called fidelity or adherence to what the model says. So,
and the model says
that you identify first those places where there is a high level of crime, you focus your resources there, but you employ a tool within this model called the Koper curve, which says that you don't over-police the area. In other words, you don't saturate a hotspot with cops 24 hours, 7 days a week. That's over-policing. You focus very clearly on the nature of the crime, the problem-solving aspects of it, for as short a period of time as maybe 15 minutes. And if you do that every few hours, you get the effect you're looking for. And this has been replicated time and time again. So in places where you have a moderate effect or a lower impact on this, it's almost always a problem with either the research design or the police were not exactly doing hotspots policing. If you oversaturate an area and say you're doing hotspots policing, you hit a point of diminishing returns and you can create other problems, because then you engage in this over-policing posture. And police officers have a tendency sometimes to get bored in these areas. They have a bias for action. They're expected by their bosses to work. And so when you focus them in an area and they spend way too much time there, they start doing things like towing cars and writing people tickets and arresting people for really minor things, because they have to produce in their mind some proof that they're actually working and not just sitting around drinking coffee. And that's where you start to get these effects that are less than optimal or counterproductive to what you're trying to do, because you're not following the prescription.
How do you ward against citizens feeling that they're under siege? For example, citizens here have complained about they're walking down the street and they're being stopped for jaywalking as kind of a prelude to perhaps do a search for drugs, or they zigzag once and they're pulled over and that becomes a prelude to search the car.
I think there's a couple of things you have to do. First of all, you have to engage the community in the discussion about an identification of what the problem is. You know, what is it we're trying to solve? What does the evidence tell us is the best plan? How are we going to go about doing that? How do we make sure that we're not off track? So some of the things you described might be more consistent with this notion of zero tolerance, that there are ways to deal with people who are jaywalking where you don't necessarily have to stop and frisk them or write them a ticket. You can simply say to them, that is not a safe thing for you to do. I'd hate for you to get hit by a car. If it's violence that you're trying to reduce, then I'm not clear how stopping people for jaywalking would actually do that. I would much more be comfortable with an agency focusing on hotspots policing as opposed to broken windows policing, simply because there's so much more science around hotspots policing. But even if you follow that to a T, I believe you still have to engage community leaders, wherever they are found, in the co-production of the decision that this is the model we're going to use. Here's how we're going to be transparent about it. Here's our results. Everything's above board. We want everybody to know what we're doing and why we're doing it, and here's the results that we're getting from that. And I think when you do that, people are much more inclined to do it, because they want you to stop the violence if that's what you're focusing on.
Well, let me run by you something that a Black Lives Matter leader said in an interview here recently on the radio, that if you put more police in an area, then you're going to end up with more arrests and more citizens having an encounter with the police, simply because they're there in the neighborhood. How do you avoid that kind of tension then, and that kind of ill feelings that can develop?
I would agree with that statement if you don't give the police officers some direction. So I just, you know, talked about the co-production of public safety through the engaging the community and sharing with them what you're doing. But you also have to have very clear discussions with the workforce, with the officers and their sergeants, supervisors, about what you're trying to achieve and how you do that. So before you push that workforce out into that neighborhood, you got to give them some training in hotspots policing. You got to say, this is what the evidence shows, and this is what we want you to do, and this is what we're trying to achieve. It is not simply a numbers issue. You know, we're not trying to see how many people we can arrest or how many tickets we can write or cars we can tow or people we can frisk. If that's what you're doing, then I think you're off base. That doesn't make sense. If you give them training and you're very clear about what it is you're trying to do, you have community buy-in, then I would disagree with that particular statement, because just putting cops out someplace does not mean that that's going to happen.
What we've been talking about here is addressing symptoms that are illustrated by high crime rates. What we haven't really talked about is the underlying causes. Kids are getting into trouble because they don't have an adequate community center to go to or community programs. Young men are on the street corners because they're unemployed. Don't we have to also look at the underlying causes in addition to treating the symptoms?
I would completely agree with that statement. So we know that a balanced and comprehensive crime control model has three components to it, much like the three legs of a tripod or a three-legged stool: prevention, intervention, and suppression strategies. If you are missing any one of those three pieces, then your tripod's going to fall over, your stool will fall over, and your crime control strategy will not be adequate. You will not be as effective as you could be. So I think it's very important that prevention and intervention strategies are employed and advocated for by the police as much as suppression activities, and that's usually where the police do their most of their work. The model that makes the most sense to me is this thing called risk and protective focused prevention. And that model says, and it's based on 30 or 40 years of longitudinal studies of the things that put young people at risk for substance abuse, delinquency, violence, dropping out of school, and teen pregnancy. And it tells everybody in the community, regardless of whether you're coming from a community advocacy group or the faith community, the business community, or the police, what role you can play in reducing the accumulation of risk in a kid's life across four domains: the community group or community domain, family domain, school, and peer group domains. And when you can identify those risk factors, which we can measure, you can even map them, you then have a prescription for what you need to address and reduce and identify. Things like low neighborhood attachment can be addressed by aspects of what we may think of as broken windows. Parental involvement with the problem behavior can be addressed through interventive strategies like drug courts or parenting project like programs that teach parents how to be better parents, especially with hard to control kids. Early academic failure is one of those risk factors. So when we think about the things that put young people at risk, it's the accumulation of risk in their life. It's not necessarily one thing. It's the accumulation of this, the availability of drugs and alcohol or firearms, in addition to these other things that cause them then to act out in these very inappropriate ways. If people think that the police alone are going to solve the problems of violence and crime and disorder, then they're sadly mistaken and being naive about the capabilities of the police, the resources they have available to them, and the knowledge that they have.
Is there a community that is successfully putting into place some of the things that you talked about, doing a good job at community policing, at hotspot policing, at addressing the underlying causes of why there's crime in a particular area?
I think there are a lot of them. Some of them have different challenges. I would want to remind your listeners that every single community is different, just like every person is different. But in terms of big cities, and I think you can divide policing up into urban, suburban, and rural experiences, they're all a little bit different. You have places like San Diego that do a fabulous job in controlling crime with few number of police officers. Philadelphia has been making exceptional advances. Camden, New Jersey has been making advances with very high levels of crime and disorder. And then there's lots of other communities that have taken approaches like Draper City, Utah, that is using this model I just talked about, or Seattle, that is using a diversion model at the police officer level, where instead of taking people to jail, the officers can literally take them right into a diversion program on the street, so they bypass the entire criminal justice system. So I think there's multiple examples of this. Each of them tells a little bit different story based on their unique natures, but I think there's a lot of places that are doing really valuable work.
We've been talking with Jim Bierman. He's the president of the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit research organization that studies best practices in policing. Thank you so much, Jim.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Judy Valente.
There are other practices police sometimes use in high crime areas. One, which Jim Bierman briefly referred to, is called broken windows policing, in which police crack down on crimes like vandalism or graffiti as a way of improving a community. Another is zero tolerance policing, in which officers enforce even minor violations of the law. Bierman says neither of those practices is proven particularly effective in reducing overall crime rates.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group and Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Susie Dees. Like you, I'm part of many organizations. My GLT contribution also makes me part of a community who believes in substance over sound bites. Recently, I was traveling for work and was glad GLT carried the Supreme Court confirmation hearing and was frustrated when my radio was no longer in range and no other radio station was playing the coverage. I learned my lesson and downloaded the app for live streaming next time. Join the GLT community and renew your financial commitment or make a first-time contribution. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
We're getting closer to meeting the fund drive goal every day. Right now, we're just $20,000 away. Can we keep it up and make the goal before the drive ends on Monday? With your help, we bet we can do that. Remember, every contribution helps pay for the GLT programs that you depend on. Don't wait. The drive ends on Monday. Contribute now. You can do it at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Bloomington's police chief says his department incorporates elements of community policing. In this conversation with GLT's John Norton, Brendan Hefner said community policing is part of the fabric of what his department should be doing. He says that means being out and engaging the public.
There are a few core tenets of community policing. One of them is officers are assigned to a geographical area, and they're assigned there for a long period of time with the idea that they get to know the neighborhood, get to know that part of the community, and maybe can get ahead of things before they actually happen. How possible is this in Bloomington? Is this something that you would be interested in ever implementing?
Well, first of all, I think all of our officers should be involved in some form of community policing because they all have assigned patrol areas every time they go out. Now, with us, we do have officers that kind of bid per their shifts, their patrol areas, so they are actually in certain areas for long periods of time, so that helps. But I think what the public doesn't realize is, say, you're an officer on 3 to 11s, or maybe day shift, and you change shifts, your patrol might change as well.
Your geographical area itself.
Yeah, okay. Your geographical area.
So it's fair to say that you implement that geographical idea in some respects, but not on a long-term basis. I mean, like years at a time, but maybe a year at a time. So you've seen some success from that.
Yes, the shift bids are, yes.
So another one of the core tenets of community policing is foot patrols, getting out, whether it's on a bike, getting out on the foot a lot as opposed to staying in the cars. Is this something that you do a lot, or is it practical for Bloomington to be out on foot a lot?
We do have foot patrols.
I mean, a little bit?
Well, obviously seasonally.
Right.
But no, we do have officers on bike patrols, and I would like, and we're going to this year again, try to get officers out of their cars more. But there's a two-pronged thing. You're out of your car more, but if you have to respond to something, if you're too far away from your car, it reduces your response time as far as if something is occurring, maybe, you know, a mile away or something within your same patrol. So you kind of balance it out.
So ideally, if you had more resources, you could have more foot patrols and more people in the cars then.
Absolutely. Okay. I can always do a lot when I have more resources.
Yeah.
But even without that, we encourage officers to get out their vehicles when they can and talk to people and engage people. And, you know, sometimes people are a little taken back because maybe they've only seen or heard things and never have an officer just say hello, conversely. And then we have some officers who are a little shy about that because of the way, you know, the atmosphere is sometimes that they don't know how they'll be treated. I just tell officers to be consistent because when you're consistent and being professional and congenial, then people will understand that you're genuine in what you're trying to do, and hopefully it comes back.
One of the criticisms of community policing across the country has been that it gets embraced at the top levels of law enforcement agencies, but it often doesn't get down to the street level, to the cops themselves. And there's a video out from a couple years ago, and it is a couple years ago, it is one single video that doesn't show a Bloomington police officer in a great light. He was trying to do community policing, as he called it, come up to a couple of guys on the street who weren't exactly embracing the officer to start with, and then he got a little kind of sassy himself. Does what you're preaching, does that get down to the street level?
Well, first of all, I did see the video, and I will have you know that after that video was up Now, bear in mind, I don't watch all the Facebook and everything. There are people who do that. That was taken down quickly by that person. And I will say that obviously it does get down to that level because that's what that officer was out there doing. And there are many viewpoints on how that conversation went because obviously it was kind of narrated from the beginning. I actually told that officer, do not stop doing what you were trying to do. That obviously was not the best contact, but that is not how everybody feels. So if you want to know if our officers try to get out and do that, they do.
But there was sort of a condescending conversation on both sides.
Right, but I believe it started out condescending. And, you know, we do have to, you know, we talk about that. We have to be above that. But one thing people have to realize is that, you know, we are human too. But we try to be above that. And could we do better in times? Yes, we can. And we strive to do that, and we learn from it. But I would hopefully don't think that people, regardless of what you think of that, that's just one video. That is not indicative, regardless of what side you're on, because we have a lot of positive contacts with the public.
You're guessing in that case, the officer could have just backed off and just said, all right, maybe another time. Obviously, they weren't receptive to the officer at that time.
Yes, that was an option that he could have chosen. But do I want that officer to stop engaging people altogether?
Right.
Absolutely not.
Another tenet is prevention as opposed to reacting, you know, problem-solving policing as opposed to reacting to events. How much of a part of the Bloomington Police Department do you incorporate that idea?
Oh, we incorporate a lot of prevention. Our presence, even in and of itself, helps prevent crimes. When we put up the cameras in certain areas, high crime areas, it's there to prevent crime. And also, we have them in areas where we have some crashes and we're moving to have more cameras. It's not to surveil people, but if we have an area that has a lot of crime, and I'm talking about our overt cameras, you know, that does help. We also do crime prevention through environmental design. Like, say, you know, when our neighborhood focus team is out by businesses or even by some people's residences, in areas that we may have had certain types of crimes, we might tell them, you know, if you cut your hedges down some so people can see your windows, then that helps you because people can't hide behind those and maybe break in your house.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. We're talking community policing with Bloomington Police Chief Brandon Hefner. I'm John Norton. One of the converging things with community policing is a militarization of police and programs like Stop and Frisk. A few months ago, the Pantograph put out a report about the first 6 months of 2016, how the number of people that were stopped, that were searched, and the numbers didn't look good for blacks especially because they were pulled over at a higher rate than whites and frisked at a higher rate than whites, but what was found on them was less than what was found on whites. Could you talk about that, and can you talk about how maybe that could make certain groups in town a little less or a little more wary of the police department?
Well, what you have to understand was that was done by someone who just, they got the information regarding the stops from our department, but they kind of created their own basis in regards to, like, patrols and different things. And actually, if you look at it, there were actually more whites stopped.
Right, but the percentage,
a higher percentage of blacks were stop and frisk. Now, first of all, I just want to be very clear. We do not have a stop and frisk program.
Okay.
That's what they did in New York. That's what happened in a couple other places. I don't tell an officer who they need to stop or frisk. First of all, there's a law called the Terry Stop, where if an officer feels a crime may be possible about to occur or there's a safety issue, they can pat a person down and do that. So factors you have to take in consideration were, yes, the numbers are what they were as far as that, but how they looked at them is kind of different because about 99% of those stop and frisks that occurred everywhere were all in our high crime areas.
Community policing is about developing relationships with individuals, with groups in town. How do you feel your relationship is with various groups in town?
I think for the most part, pretty good. And just because your relationship isn't good, that doesn't represent everybody. There are certain groups in town that want to give the impression, I would feel, in social media and others, that that's how everyone within that particular ethnicity feels, far from the truth. I will tell you that there is a person who is a part of a certain group that came to a focus meeting that I had and said some negative things, and then later on, after the community house was approved by the council, came and told me they supported the community house, and after seeing the work that it went in and the background on it, because they were not aware of all that information before, fully supported it and had actually supported us. They just had a different narrative at the time.
Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you coming in again.
Thank you.
Hefner says the bottom line of any form of community policing is for officers to get out of their cars and engage with people or stop and talk with citizens on the street, even if the conversation is brief. Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner spoke with GLT's John Norton. At our website, that's where you can find the Sound Ideas podcast, along with individual interviews that you heard today. Thanks to John Norton and Judy Valente. I'm Willis Kern. Our website's also where you can leave a comment about Sound Ideas. You can also post at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at W.E. Kern, and we're all at WGLT.org. And don't forget, when you're at our website, make a contribution to support Sound Ideas as we wind up the spring fund drive in just a few days. That's WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.